This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
The Kremlin needs more men to fight. That sent Russians fleeing the country to avoid a draft.
So I don't want to fight for this president, so...
So he's thinking about a life outside of Russia. Also today, Willie Sutton said he robbed banks because that's where the money is. In Lebanon, account holders are doing it because that's where their money is.
These heists are just an expression of hopelessness, really, because there are no other channels for people to regain access to their savings.
I'm Marco Werman, and NASA gets the ultimate high score in a real-life video game. They targeted an asteroid with a small spacecraft.
It did have a bit of a hefty weight there, even though it's only about the size of a refrigerator, and it was traveling at about 14,000 miles per hour. And so those things together really made a spectacular crash.
All today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. It is the final day of voting in southern and eastern Ukraine, parts of the country occupied by Russian forces. Some preliminary results were announced today, and in a surprise to pretty much no one, they showed around 97% support for Russian annexation of these areas. Many world leaders have said these votes are not free or fair since they're taking place under military occupation. They're also illegal under international law. Ukraine's government rejects the entire process as illegitimate.
Псевдореферендуми також говорили. Реакція світу на них і на будь-які.
President Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking yesterday, said these are sham referendums and that the global response will be severe. Denis Pushilin, the Kremlin-appointed leader of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic in eastern Ukraine, cast his ballot last week in favor of joining Russia.
Сьогодні твориться історія.
History is being made, he said. The only right way is towards Russia. Some voters have reportedly been forced to vote yes on annexation. The U.S. and other Western countries have said they do not recognize the results. Here's U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
The United States will never recognize Russia's claims to any purportedly annexed parts of Ukraine. And we will never recognize this territory as anything other than a part of Ukraine.
Meanwhile, inside Russia, a nationwide mobilization effort is underway with mixed results. The Russian defense minister announced last week that the military is calling up an additional 300,000 troops to fight in Ukraine. In response, many in Russia who support the war are answering the Kremlin's call and enlisting. Others fear that the mobilization effort will not be limited to 300,000, and they're worried about being sent to the front lines. In some parts of Russia, people are openly protesting the call-up. In Russia's Dagestan region, police officers reportedly fired into the air, trying to disperse crowds of protesters. In a speech on Sunday, President Zelensky of Ukraine sent a direct message to the Russian public. Zelensky said Russian troops should surrender to Ukrainian forces or flee the country to avoid being drafted into what he called this aggressive war. In recent days, thousands of military-age Russian men have fled to avoid being pulled into military service. Now there are concerns that President Vladimir Putin will invoke a law banning them from traveling abroad. Long lines of people are forming at some border crossings. Ticket prices for flights out of Russia are soaring because of the high demand. Many Russian men are flying to countries that are still open, like Turkey, Armenia, Georgia, and Kazakhstan. We have more on that story from the world's Duri Buscarin at the airport in Istanbul, Turkey.
It's late. A batch of Russian planes have just landed in Istanbul, as they do most nights, from Moscow, St. Petersburg, Sochi.
Are you originally from Sochi? Is that your hometown?
No, no. St. Petersburg is my hometown.
Okay. Is Turkey your final destination?
To be honest, I don't know.
This 30-year-old shipping industry worker is here on a business trip, but he's not sure if he'll go back to Russia, even though he fights back tears when he talks about leaving his mother there.
So I don't want to fight for this president, so I will think later, maybe.
He says his friends are fleeing the country as airlines push prices through the roof. One friend booked an $8,000 ticket to Tbilisi, Georgia. Another considered a flight to Kazakhstan. He pulls out his phone to show the itinerary.
I can just show you. This is a ticket from St. Petersburg to Almaty, Kazakhstan.
A one-way ticket with three transfers.
2 days, 8 hours, 30 minutes. And the price is a little bit more than $10,000. Only millionaire guys can now buy it.
All of the people interviewed for this story asked that we not use their names due to the risks they would face in Russia for opposing the war. Many spoke of booking tickets weeks before the announcement of the draft and realizing this might be their last chance to leave.
Если мы сейчас не уедем из России, возможно, мы в ближайшие лет пять.
As this 27-year-old waited with his girlfriend for a flight to Barcelona, he mulled the option of staying in Spain permanently. He says he has no intention of fighting in this war, and he's willing to leave Russia to avoid it.
Ну, это огромная ошибка.
I think the war is a huge mistake, he says. It just makes the lives of ordinary people harder. When he left Moscow, officers pulled him aside and questioned him. What's your conscription number? Why are you leaving the country? Where's your return ticket?
С ожиданием. Но всех выпускают пока что.
They're still letting people leave for now, he says. But we don't know how long that will last. His girlfriend says she'll stay with him.
Также отреагировала, что надо валить.
When we heard the news, we knew we had to leave, she says. The flights arrive daily, dozens of them, from all over Russia. Most travelers seem to be families on vacation, with strollers and big suitcases. Turkey is still a popular destination for Russians, who can stay without a visa for up to 3 months. Others are like this soft-spoken 26-year-old, alone, exhausted, carrying just a backpack on his way to join his sister in Dubai. Deciding whether to leave was on his mind for a while.
I thought about it, but...
He's from Rostov-on-Don, a city not far from the Ukrainian city of Mariupol, where many families have relatives on both sides of the border. We have a lot of love for Ukraine, he says. The majority of people don't support this war, he says. I think it's a powerful choice to be against this war, and it's difficult, but I'm against it, he says. His plan is to take an English class in Dubai. Then he'll try and find work. For the world, I'm Derya Buzkaryan in Istanbul.
Spaceship collides with asteroid. It sounds like something worth fact-checking, but you know what? It actually happened. Yesterday, NASA successfully carried out its double asteroid redirection test, or DART mission. The target, Dimorphos, the moon of a larger asteroid. And don't worry, this all took place nearly 7 million miles from Earth. Upon impact on NASA's live webcast, the engineers at Mission Control were on their feet.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
Christina Thomas was also watching. She's a planetary scientist at Northern Arizona University and lead for the Observations Working Group for NASA's DART mission. I asked her just how big of an achievement it was to target an asteroid successfully mid-flight.
I mean, this is really a phenomenal accomplishment, and I have nothing but the utmost respect for our engineering team. This is the first time that we have tested the kinetic impactor for planetary defense, and we did it in such a technologically impressive way by using the SmartNav system to do the autonomous guiding towards the end, right before the impact.
So what did this refrigerator-sized craft actually do when you say kinetic impact? Did it blow the asteroid to bits or kind of just, I mean, I guess we'll know in a few months whether it nudged it onto a different trajectory.
We basically took our spacecraft, which, like you said, is refrigerator-sized, and we impacted it directly into the moon of a binary asteroid system, so the moon of a larger object. And that moon's called Dimorphos. And Dimorphos looked very much like a rubble pile. And once we hit that, we could immediately see that a lot of ejecta material was thrown off of the object. And so we're really ultimately looking at how we have changed the orbital period of that moon around the larger object Didymos.
Remind us of the theory underlying this whole mission.
Right. So we're thinking about how you might deflect an asteroid many years, potentially decades in advance of a potential encounter with the Earth. So you could take something that's relatively small, like the DART spacecraft, and impact it into an object that's significantly larger than it. Dimorphos, in this case, is about the size of the Great Pyramid of Giza. And so it's not something that is, you know, kind of mind-blowingly large, like the impactor that caused the dinosaur extinction event, but it is something that's significantly larger than the DART spacecraft itself. And so if you actually impact the spacecraft into the object, then you're going to get a relatively small change in the overall motion. But over time, if we actually had to do this to defend the planet, over time that change would propagate out into a successful deflection where the asteroid would not intersect with our planet. And so in this case, we impacted into Dimorphos, which currently has an orbital period around Didymos of 11 hours and 55 minutes. And we're looking to shorten that orbital period. And in the coming weeks, we're going to have a lot of telescopes observing this orbital period from the ground to seeing exactly how we changed it.
So just to be clear, Christina, Didymos, is it seen as a threat, or was this mission really to establish that there is a way to knock asteroids off a flight path toward Earth and in the eventuality that that could happen?
Didymos is not a threat to the planet. This is primarily just a test so that we could see how this would play out. What are the factors that we need to consider and be able to use this technique in the future should we have to defend the planet?
I mean, the video that was rendered from this impact is pretty amazing. You see the camera zooming in on Dimorphos slowly, 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 and then boom, lights out. Was this craft that was sent crashing into the asteroid? I mean, the mass must have been huge.
The DART spacecraft was a bit over 1,000 pounds in mass when it actually did impact into Dimorphos, and it was traveling at about 14,000 miles per hour. And So those things together really made a spectacular crash.
So there are lots of asteroids out there, but if there are no real small asteroid threats to planet Earth, are there other uses for this technology that was demonstrated yesterday?
I think that there's a lot of different thoughts that people have on, you know, asteroids in general. And I know that folks, you know, continually come back to thinking about the resources available on those objects. And so it'd be very interesting to see kind of how some of these technologies play out. But right now, we're primarily thinking about this from a planetary defense perspective, and also thinking about this as a way to unite the world behind a single common potential problem.
Christina Thomas is a professor of astronomy and planetary sciences at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff and lead for the Observations Working Group for NASA's DART mission. That's the Double Asteroid Redirection Test. Christina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Check out that moment of impact. We have the video linked on our website, theworld.org. There's been some movement we wanted to share with you about a few stories we reported last week. This first one from Cuba. Last Friday, the world's TBCSA previewed a referendum to approve major reforms to the Catholic-majority country's family code.
If the new family code is approved by voters on Sunday, Cuba will become the 8th country in Latin America to legalize same-sex marriage.
As Tropical Storm Ian was barreling toward Cuba, voters went to the polls across the island and approved the measure by a 2/3 majority. It legalizes gay marriage in Cuba, plus adoption by gay couples. It also gives a boost to women's rights. Also last week, we had the news of another deadly tropical storm in the Caribbean. Hurricane Fiona was tearing into Puerto Rico.
To the people of Puerto Rico, we are thinking of you. Please stay safe.
That's Maya Hollingshed, star forward for Puerto Rico's national basketball team. They beat China in the FIBA World Cup last night. Hollingshed and her teammates dedicated their victory to the people of Puerto Rico. Today, Hollingshed led her team to another victory, this time over South Korea.
Look at that, the passion of this Puerto Rican squad. They are moving on.
And an update to another competition we told you about last week in the world of chess. Norwegian world champion Magnus Carlsen lost to a 19-year-old American, Hans Niemann, earlier this month. Then last week, Carlsen started to play another match against Niemann, but resigned after he made his first move. Carlsen did not say why, but there was a lot of speculation. Today he made it clear, and the chess internet lit up.
Yo controversy ma Magnus Carlsen ra Hans Niemann.
We've been waiting to hear from Magnus Carlsen regarding the Hans.
Magnus Carlsen confirmed in a statement today that he made the unprecedented decision to drop out of that match because, yes, he believed that Hans Niemann was cheating. Carlsen wrote, "I know that my actions have frustrated many in the chess community." He continued, "I'm frustrated. I want to play chess. I want to continue to play chess at the highest level in the best events." No doubt that story is not over yet. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The government in Lebanon has ordered banks closed for the foreseeable future. The reason? Too many bank heists. There have been at least 8 separate incidents this month, according to news reports. The bank robbers are not professional criminals. They're bank customers. The World's Shirin Jafari explains.
28-year-old Sally Hafez never thought she would rob a bank. But on Wednesday, September 14th, that's exactly what she did. Hafez walked into her own bank in Beirut, waved a gun in the air, and demanded $20,000. The whole thing was live-streamed online. I reached Hafez on a WhatsApp call at an undisclosed location in Lebanon. "I'm not a criminal," she told me, "so in my mind, I pretended I was a character in a movie." After a few tense minutes, bank employees scrambled to give her handfuls of cash. Hafez walked out with $13,000. In the end, no one was hurt. The gun Hafez used turned out to be a toy that belonged to her nephew. Heists like these have become so common in Lebanon that the government has ordered the banks shut.
What we're seeing now, what we're witnessing in Lebanon, is just a symptom of, you know, the economic violence that has been enforced on the people for decades.
Hossein Sharito is an economist with the Tahrir Institute. Since 2019, he says Lebanon's currency has lost 90% of its value. Foreign investment has dried up, and depositors have tried to withdraw their savings, he says. This led to a shortage of foreign currency, including U.S. dollars. And in response, the banks set a limit on how much customers can withdraw. It's between $200 and $400 a month, he says, depending on the bank. Or they can exchange their dollars for Lebanese pounds at a much lower rate.
So these heists are just, in a way, an expression of hopelessness, really, because there are no other channels for people to regain access to their savings.
Sally Hafez, who held up the bank earlier this month, said she needed the money for her sister's cancer treatment. Samia Sibare works with an advocacy group called the Depositors Outcry Association.
Depositors in Lebanon are around 2 million.
2 million people, including those who are older or sick and simply need the money for life-saving medical treatment. Sibaya, who is a math teacher, says all her own inheritance money is frozen in a bank.
Many problems. I'm facing many problems. Like, I couldn't pay for my son's university fees. Then he stopped studying for about 6 months.
She says for the last 3 years, her advocacy group has tried everything from filing multiple lawsuits to protesting in the streets to pleading face-to-face with the president and the prime minister.
Nobody in this whole country is willing to give solutions.
45-year-old Ibrahim Abdullah says people in other countries listening to reports about bank heists in Lebanon might be shocked.
People will not understand that because it's like, oh, against law or something. It's not against law. The banks are against law.
Abdullah has been protesting in front of banks for months. He says he has about $3 million that he can't take out. It's his savings from 16 years of working in Dubai as a sales manager for a real estate developer.
I don't want to die. I don't want to be a criminal. My money is in front of me and the bank is working and enjoying profits. I can't afford medicines for my parents. I can't afford food. I can't afford electricity bills.
Abdullah says he returned to Lebanon to be closer to his parents, who are in their 70s and 80s. He also wanted to study for an MBA. Instead, he says his life is consumed with figuring out how to get access to his own money.
Someone was working 16 years in a senior position. We are like educated people. So they are forcing us now to become like part of attacking banks. So it's not our nature. It's not us.
But until the banks and the government in Lebanon figure out a plan to give people access to their savings, the frustration is not going to go away. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The government of Pakistan is warning it could take months for the high water to fully recede there following catastrophic flooding at the end of the summer. During the monsoon season, hundreds of people were killed and millions were displaced across Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. Our next guest studies how development can play a huge role in how and where cities flood. Malini Ranganathan is an urban geographer at American University. I asked her about the connection between flooding and real estate.
I think when we talk about the connection between real estate capitalism and flooding, there's really three factors we have to look at. So the first is economics. There's a good amount of money to be made in land transactions. Take the city of Bangalore in southern India. Its population has grown threefold in a matter of 30 years.
And that's been driven by its kind of like reputation as a tech hub, right?
That's correct. It also has land that could cheaply be developed and turned over to technology companies, many of which are headquartered in Europe and America. The second factor that really matters here is the ecology. The city was built up around wetlands, and it's hard to actually make out where they exist because of all the concrete until and unless it rains. The blockage of all these storm flows and these waterways comes back to kind of wreak havoc on the city. The third and final that I'd like to bring to light is policy. The government has bent over backwards to lure development, you know, offering all kinds of incentives around land and the deregulation of land to make it possible for these companies to locate there.
Do you see these disastrous environmental consequences of real estate development in other parts of the world, not just South Asia?
A lot of dense urban areas have grown around water bodies, around coastal areas. The closest example that comes to mind, of course, is New Orleans, where we see a lot of development of the coast and infrastructure projects that have also led to more risky and precarious conditions. We see it happening in major cities of Africa, including Lagos and Nairobi, both of which are built around wetlands. Again, the prosperous and the powerful are the ones that kind of have free license to develop these wetlands to the detriment of the city's residents, middle class and working class residents, who then will be most affected, you know, every time it floods.
So a global problem with these links between government officials and private developers that are often complex and opaque. Is there any hope these development patterns can change? Like, what would that take?
I really think a lot about this question, and I do think that more understanding and exposure of the nexus that exists between real estate interests and political interests really needs to be exposed. In India, at least, there's been several citizen-led campaigns, anti-corruption campaigns that are really centered around trying to expose misdoings in the real estate sector. Those kinds of citizen-led campaigns have given me hope because I think they shift the narrative to not just being growth at all costs, but really, you know, growth at whose cost and to whose benefit.
Malini Ranganathan is an urban geographer at American University in Washington, speaking with us about the real estate pressures that exacerbate flooding in South Asia and around the globe. Thanks very much for unpacking this.
Thank you for having me.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. New forensic technology paints a vivid picture of how Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed. Researchers recreated the vantage point of Israeli soldiers down to the millimeter.
We know actually the exact hole that they shot out of, and we can reconstruct their exact vision because of that. We can actually see what they saw as they were firing throughout the incident.
Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Thinking about booking a holiday to London? Now is the time to do it. Yesterday, Great Britain's currency hit a record low compared with the U.S. dollar. For the Brits, the slumping value of the pound has created something of a currency crisis. It's also a situation being watched closely by the rest of Europe. To unpack this, we turn to Giancarlo Corsetti. He studies financial crises at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy. Giancarlo, what's making the pound fall so sharply right now?
Well, that's the $1 million question. The answer seems to be pretty clear in the short run. For the next few months, a lot of deficit. And that created tension in the financial market because they wanted to know what the Bank of England would do, whether they would keep their focus on inflation and raise rates, or being asked by the Treasury to be calm, you know, gradual. The sterling fell a lot because investors were unclear whether the Bank of England would intervene or not.
Let me ask you first, I mean, how much blame can be laid at the feet of Prime Minister Liz Truss for plans to cut taxes? I mean, there is also the war in Ukraine, high energy prices, global inflation worries. It's not like she inherited a winning hand from Boris Johnson, her predecessor, is it?
No. It was a little bit unexpected, this kind of, some people may say, cavalier, no, start. Was definitely not welcome.
There's another thing I saw some economists talking about today. Liz Truss is cutting taxes and encouraging Brits to borrow more, just as the British Central Bank is raising interest rates. Don't central banks raise interest rates to tap the brakes in an effort to get people not to borrow so much and slow things down a bit? So what do these two seemingly opposite moves amount to while the value of the pound is tanking?
You're right. You're spot on. Many people say it's like having a car and pushing at the same time, pedal or the accelerator and the brake. This was a tough spot for the Bank of England. I don't think they expected such a big jump in the fiscal policy. That is not the way it works today. And markets immediately made this very clear.
So let's talk about inflation for a moment. Inflation in the UK is hovering around 10%. That's worse than here in the US. How does this factor into the problems with the British currency, the pound?
Oh, yeah, that is exactly the problem. People expected the Bank of England to walk a thin line of sort of being decisive against inflation without really creating a recession. And all of a sudden, there is this massive budget deficit that requires a revision of the Bank of England path and also a kind of maybe a different engagement of the Bank of England with the Treasury.
Mm. So the answer to why is this happening, as you said, million-dollar question. It's also a million-pound question as the two currencies sit basically at parity now. People and investors around the globe getting nervous about what's happening in the UK. Is there any chance there could be a ripple effect elsewhere in the world because of the pound's sudden loss in value?
That is definitely something that has been on the table. I think even the U.S. started to signal that it's not a good idea to play around with this kind of budget deficit today. Remember, we come out of COVID globally with an enormous amount of debt. We need to understand how to keep this enormous mass of debt from preventing most countries from doing the right thing. We need to spend for energy transition. We need to spend for social inclusion. We need to spend on technology. Playing around with that is today very dangerous.
I mean, Giancarlo, it sounds like what you're saying is that this is not distinctly a British problem. So what happens when other countries do not do the right thing?
The UK is not a special situation. It is a reminder of the vulnerabilities, not sensitivity, of the how fragile things are. I just came out of a post-election day today in Italy where the new coalition was supposed to send, sort of rattling effect throughout the markets, and it didn't. Perhaps a little bit was a lesson learned from the UK. So seeing what happened in the UK last week, I think, made all Italian politicians, right or left, way more cautious, pushing their agendas, regardless of the effect on the public policy. But many other countries with the burden of debt may enter crisis, and that could be, one of the biggest global crises that we remember. Like, we go all the way back to 2008. something comparable globally. We don't need that. We don't need that. It would be nice to avoid that.
It would be really nice to avoid that for sure.
It would be very nice. I always be like, I quote my daughter and say, it would be nice to avoid that. It would be nice to avoid that.
Giancarlo Corsetti studies financial crises at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy, which is where he joined us from. Giancarlo, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's routine for cyber cops to shut down dark websites that traffic illegal drugs, but the seizure of an encrypted Russian language website, that was pretty different. Hydra was the biggest dark web market the world has ever known. It essentially professionalized the cyber marketplace for drug dealers. There were codes of conduct, sophisticated distribution systems, even quality control measures. Reporter Dina Temple-Raston with the Click Here podcast explains how it all worked.
A few years ago, this flashy ad started making the rounds on Russian YouTube.
Говорят, смех продлевает жизнь.
There's a picture of a happy-looking guy in his 30s, all tousled hair and perfectly trimmed beard. And then an animated cloud appears over his head, one of those thought balloons from the cartoons. And in it pops two things, some joints and a pile of weed. Seconds later, there's a photograph of him grinning, ear to ear, and giving a big thumbs up.
Не оставит тебя равнодушным. Переходи на Гидра.
It's a very short advert, but I think it's really beautifully made, and you don't really need to speak Russian to understand what it's advertising.
That's Patrick Shortis, a darknet market expert. And he says the ad was part of a marketing blitz for a Russian darknet market called Hydra. It specialized in trafficking illegal drugs, and its claim to fame was that it worked out novel approaches to solve common darknet problems.
There is a lot of work right now within the Russian darknet to professionalize.
Professionalize, to correct those little hiccups that put friction in the system. Irritants like last-mile delivery. Hydra's administrators did a very clever and creative thing. Instead of having a customer buy some illegal drugs on the dark web and then wait for the vendor to go out and come back and send an address where they could pick it up, Hydra decided to pre-position things.
What Hydra did was the invention of auto shops, or instant treasures, as it's also referred to. What this means is that as a drug dealer, I can go out, I can drop deliveries of drugs all across the cities, and then I can come back and all the time I've been working, each location that's uploaded to the site is instantly available for sale.
Like Amazon lockers all over Moscow and St. Petersburg that you just have to drive to and unlock.
There are thousands and thousands of packages of drugs waiting for someone to purchase their location and pick them up.
Someone like this guy.
So, hi, I'm Nico Vorobyov. I'm a narcotics connoisseur.
Nico Vorobyov is a kind of expert in all things drug trade. He wrote a pretty good book called Dope World. And a few years ago, he found himself in a famous Moscow park to, well, pick up a little something from Hydra.
And you get the coordinates, and you also get sent these pictures with, like, these terribly drawn arrows in Microsoft Paint, showing you where exactly, like, which tree or which bench or which bin or in which pipe they've hidden the stuff in. And then off you go.
Off you go on a treasure hunt.
The packet is actually buried, like, a little bit under the tree. We're standing by this tree, picking up bits of dead wood around this. Actually took us 5-10 minutes. You know, sometimes there's a risk that you find something, and it's actually like another package for someone else.
That's right. There are so many Hydra drops in Moscow and St. Petersburg that you can accidentally find the wrong thing.
This is the standard way of hiding drugs in Russia.
There's a whole vocabulary around this. Patrick says someone who digs up and steals drugs that don't belong to them is called a seagull, like the bird.
And when I asked a Russian friend, you know, is this actually the word seagull? They said, yes, yes. And I was like, so why do they call them that? And he said, because like the seagull, they steal the chips from your mouth. And I was just like, okay, that's a good phrase.
Niko Vorobyov, our friend in the park, said he'd been seagulled, if that can be a verb. And you might be surprised how it all ended up.
Me and these Armenian guys tried to buy some cocaine. And actually, we couldn't find the cocaine. The Hydra, the dealer on Hydra, they gave us our money back because the cocaine wasn't there. So like that goes back to your question before, what happens if you find something that's not yours? Well, this is what happens.
Hydra responded the way any good business would. They made the customer happy, and they got their money back. Hydra also went next level on customer service. It actually set up a testing operation. They do random drug buys from the site and then have a real chemist actually analyze the drugs to see if they're really what the vendor says they are. They weigh them, too, to see if a vendor is being honest or maybe shorting his customers. And if you're having some unusually bad reaction to whatever you just bought from Hydra, they have a solution for that, too.
Hydra had its own health service where you were able to speak to a doctor or get general advice about safe use of drugs.
Alexei Lakoff knows about this firsthand.
I talked to a doctor, a substance abuse specialist from Hydra, but he seemed like a true professional to me.
And it's a little funny because Lakoff is also a substance abuse specialist. He runs something called the Drug Map Project in St. Petersburg, Russia. And it never really occurred to him that he'd end up working side by side with administrators from Russia's largest darknet drug site. He got in touch with the Hydra administrators and worked out a deal. They said he could post information about the Drug Map Project and harm reduction right there on the Hydra site.
They even promoted us a little bit.
Were you surprised by that?
At first I was surprised, but then I thought a little bit more about it, and I understood that they wanted their clients to be as healthy as possible and as long as possible.
Because then they can still buy drugs.
Yeah, definitely.
Successful darknet markets in the West pull down, if they're lucky, tens of millions of dollars in commissions and subscription fees. And typically, they stay open for about 2 years before police shut them down. And Hydra? It was pulling down billions and managed to keep its virtual doors open for 7 years. So it had not only diversified, it seemed to be everywhere.
Hydra is kind of like the heart. It's like the lifeblood of these illicit networks. It's connected.
Kim Grauer is the director of research at Chainalysis. It provides compliance and investigation software to financial institutions and governments so they can track cryptocurrency transactions. And a lot of her investigations led back to Hydra.
We've been tracking Hydra for years, and it is doing so much more than just selling drugs at this point. It's doing money laundering. It's involved in ransomware attacks.
Kim said some $2 billion worth of crypto was laundered by Hydra last year alone. And 2022 was looking like another banner year, as they became the launderer and mixer of choice for Russian cybercriminals and other Russian speakers trying to move big money. People, say, who were paying for the upkeep of their super yachts and their mistresses' apartments in Paris.
They have networks that are really good at moving large quantities of money for high net worth individuals in a way that doesn't attract international attention, does it in a kind of quiet way. They also don't ask a lot of questions at times about who the people are that they're receiving funds from.
So it's exactly like a Swiss bank.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way, right?
In a way. So in a way. And they do it, and they will take 5-10% off of a fee. That's the price of not asking questions.
Well, a major bust on the dark web. The largest and longest running illegal marketplace in all the world is shut down.
In April, working with U.S. law enforcement, the German federal police took down Hydra servers and seized some $25 million in Bitcoin. Now there's a name and a face connected to the marketplace. The man allegedly behind Hydra, or at least allegedly managed its servers in Russia, is 30-year-old Dmitry Pavlov. Russian police say he's in a Moscow prison now. Which begs the question, now what? who or what is going to pick up where Hydra left off. And Niko Vorobyov, the guy who wrote Dope World, says Hydra won't be easily replaced. Remember, it was a billion-dollar business that involved hundreds of people working together to make things happen. And now, they've all been scattered to the wind.
Now there's like three or four websites fighting, like competing between each other for the for a monopoly. One of them was called like OMG, OMG, OMG.
Oh my God.
This is from an OMG ad.
This is going to take a while to get running. These doctors, like the doctors that they had on their payroll, like nobody really knows each other in real life. So I think right. I think it'll eventually come back, but it's going to take a while for all the relevant people to find each other in the wilds of the internet.
For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast about all things cyber and intelligence. Her story was produced by Sean Powers and Will Jarvis. In May, Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed while on assignment in the West Bank in Israel. There's been deep disagreement as to how she was killed, but now an organization has aimed to reconstruct the scene where it all happened using advanced 3D modeling. The group behind this independent investigation says it is now clear Israeli occupation forces undoubtedly targeted and shot Abu Akleh. Her death had sparked a UN investigation and protests around the world. In response to the new modeling, Democrats in the U.S. Senate have renewed their calls for a thorough investigation. The models were made by researchers with the group Forensic Architecture at Goldsmiths College at the University of London. One member of the team from the organization, Omar Farwati, joins us now. So your team scanned the town of Jenin with drones and built a 3D model, Omar. The spot where Abu Akleh was killed is at the end of a long roadway. Abu Akleh was at one end. The bullet came from the other, a couple of blocks away. Who fired the shot, according to your investigation?
Well, our investigation shows very clearly that is the occupation forces, Israeli occupation forces, that shot and killed Shireen and injured one of her colleagues and repeatedly fired at the entire group of journalists, as well as a civilian that was trying to provide aid to Shireen after she had been shot and fallen to the ground.
So what was different about the way you undertook this investigation? What was revealed or what tools were used that had not been used before?
By creating a model that's measurable to the millimeter, this photographic scan of the site is an exact replica. Through this model, we're able to actually situate the footage that we have and understand the footage in relation to each other. So imagine recreating the camera or view of one piece of footage. By doing that, we're able to also reconstruct the precise position of Shireen and her colleagues, as well as for the first time, the position exactly of the Israeli occupation forces when the incident occurred.
So you're saying your finding is so precise that you're able to know exactly where the bullet was shot from?
Yes, we're able to know the exact vehicle that it was shot from, but we're also able to know the actual hole it was shot from. These armored military vehicles of the Israeli army have sniper holes in which a trained and professional marksman of the special unit can peer out of. So yes, we know actually the exact hole that they shot out of, and we can reconstruct their exact vision because of that. We can actually see what they saw as they were firing throughout the incident.
Could it have been a warning shot?
No, there's absolutely no way that any of these shots could have been warning shots. And it's important to note that this is not one shot. We're talking about 16 intentional shots.
I mean, the clear identification of press credentials on Shireen and her colleagues seems pretty key. The IDF says they will not pursue charges against their soldiers. But based on your investigation, can you determine if the shooting was premeditated or a series of events that once they began inevitably led to Shireen's death? And is there any way to know this?
Yes, I think, we see from our findings that any idea of misidentification or accident is inconceivable. The evidence of this is that we are able to through our research of the bullet that killed Shireen, which is an armor-piercing bullet of a marksman, we're able to know that they are equipped usually with a scope on their rifle that magnifies their vision 4 times. So we can reconstruct this vision and see exactly what they see. And you can see in this video report yourselves that they were clearly identifiable as press, and they were clearly identifiable throughout the entire series of shootings. I mean, 16 shots.
How have your team's findings been received? Like, any reaction from the IDF?
We're not really interested in those reactions, but from what we understand, there has been nothing new. It's been a reiteration of past claims of no evidence for opening an investigation, which is very false and misleading of a statement that there was somehow some misidentification, that there was this large firefight that they were caught in between of.
As you know, a large number of Senate Democrats have now signed a letter asking for more accountability into what happened to Shireen that day in May. Have Senate Democrats spoken to your team about your report?
No, we have not, as of yet, heard from any senators.
Omar Farwati is a researcher from the group Forensic Architecture at Goldsmiths at the University of London. Using technology, his team analyzed the circumstances around the death of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in May in the West Bank. Omar, thank you very much for explaining all this.
Thank you very much.
A few weeks ago, the Israel Defense Forces concluded its investigation into the death of Shireen Abu Akleh. It said there was a high possibility that Abu Akleh was accidentally hit by IDF gunfire, fired towards suspects identified as armed Palestinian gunmen. An IDF official said Israeli soldiers were not aware they were firing at journalists. They thought they were firing at militants firing at them. A bourrée, a dance from 17th century Europe. Like many composers on the continent at the time, J.S. Bach wrote a number of works that featured bourrées. This one from Bach's Violin Partita No. 3 in E major, performed by Hilary Hahn. If you know how to dance to this, and you've obviously studied a lot of the complex footwork that is central to Baroque dance. Don't feel constrained by orthodoxy, though. The members of Lodestar Trio certainly don't. They took the same bourrée you were just hearing and took it into a decidedly Scandinavian direction. It's hard to pin Lodestar Trio down to a single regional musical style. The members are Swedish, Norwegian, and German-British violinists. But when they set out to adapt Bach's bourrée for a Scandinavian dance, they added the Swedish nyckelharpa. It looks like a violin, but instead of placing one's finger on the string to change the tone, there are keys on the neck of the nyckelharpa that serve that purpose. The nickel harpa almost plays the role of a slide guitar, leaving the sense that you're at a country dance, not in a ballroom at a royal court. We leave you today with the sounds of Lodestar Trio's Bach to Folk. That's the title of their just-released album. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. Thanks for making it today. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.